you ever wonder what parenting is really like? Do you think that you're the only one that's struggling? Or have you missed out on that amazing hack everyone was talking about? Well, that sounds like you. Grab a seat and get comfy, as you'll be hearing real life stories from parents that are on the same collective journey, a little thing called parenthood. We'll hear from parents, caregivers, and experts as we fumble through this wonderful path together. I'm your host, Rashida, and welcome to the Parents Connecting Podcast. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Today, you're going to be hearing my conversation with Kara, a Vermont-based early childhood educator, collaborative parenting coach, and the founder of Core for Parenting. We talk about all things pandemic, raising COVID babies, what it was like going through the survival mode, and how Kara helps parents through this period and after, what happens after. Through keynotes, teacher trainings, and her own podcast, Transforming the Toddler Years, she's teaching the five executive functioning skills that kids need to recover lost milestones and navigate this ever-changing world. And we talk about these five executive functioning skills during our conversations, so get ready to learn. All right, let's get into it. Well, hi, Kara. I'm so excited to talk with you. Thank you for joining the Parents Connecting podcast. We're going to be talking about parenting through the pandemic, which is a topic that I have been really wanting to talk to someone about. So I am very excited to talk with you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a topic that's really, really important to me, since I typically work with parents who parented through the pandemic with infants and toddlers. So we are in it.
So why don't we just start off with just a little bit about you, you know, where you live, how many kids you have, their ages. It seems like you've got grown kids. So just, yeah, give us a little bit of background.
So hey, everyone, I am Kara Terrell. I'm the founder of Core for Parenting, which is a collaborative parenting methodology for teaming up with your kids to learn and grow together and become problem solvers. And it's just so powerful. So I live in Vermont and I have grown kids. I have girls, they're 18 and 20, and I'm watching them, I'm launching them, right? Tackle life. They're just out there doing the hard stuff. I have one who moved to Japan.
Oh, wow.
And so all the things that she's like, oh, this is an issue. I have the strategies and skills to know how to solve it. It's really powerful to watch the adult version of my little people go out there and spread their joy.
That's amazing. So how did you get into the Core for Parenting? Like, tell us a little bit about how that kind of came up and what you were doing when they were toddlers, because now they're grown.
Yeah. So this is really a fun story. So I am an educator. I'm a trained teacher, an early childhood educator. So I was in preschool and kindergarten classrooms when my kids were preschoolers and kindergartners. And let me just tell you right now, as much energy as it takes to navigate other people's children all day long and give them the space and energy and love and attention that they need, and then come home to same aged kids, that was a long, trying period for me.
And did you have the skill set at that time that you have, like, now that you're now teaching to folks externally, or have you, like, evolved as a parent and as an educator?
I love that question. I innately and intuitively had parts and pieces of it in place, but it was by no means refined. And so I am sorry to say that most weeks it was my kids who took the brunt of my lack of patience at the end of the day, my lack of flexibility at the end of the day. It just was true. And so I knew I had to come up with a way of finding a way to self-regulate me, so that I could continue to meet my kids where they were, because the whole reason I had them was that so they could get the best of me.
Yeah. It's self-regulation is so important. I mean, this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart because, you know, I've got two young children, 2 and 5, and you're right. It's a very trying period. And now there is so much information out there. I mean, and a lot, and it's so good. But it's really challenging to navigate what skill set to use, what tool to use when your kid is dysregulated. And you yourself, like, you know, as a parent, it's very easy to get triggered. And so I'm curious to learn how you
managed that through it's, and I'm glad that you're sharing that it was difficult for you, because I think some people think, oh, well, you know, as an educator, I've got it all figured out and my kids are, you know, get the best of me, but that's not reality. And so talk to us about that.
So let me share this really fun story. So I have a client who is a first grade teacher. And when I first met her while she was pregnant, she said, I'm great at classroom management. I have a class of X amount of kids. I keep them all under control. I'm totally in tune with their needs. I feel really confident that I'm going to be able to rock this parenting thing. And then during the first year of her child's life, as we were working together, she went, Cara, it's so different. Oh my gosh, am I glad that I'm part of your world, because otherwise I would have set myself up for an unrealistic expectation. So they are really different. And here's what happened. I decided as a classroom teacher that I was noticing that these 4 and 5 year olds, they were coming to school with parents who truly believed that they had set their kids up for success to be ready to learn. Because the world told them, if you teach your kids their ABCs, 1, 2, 3s, colors, and numbers, guess what? You did your job. They're ready and they're going to thrive in that classroom. And the truth is, less and less kids were coming with any skills outside of that. The ability to socially navigate a friendship or understand when it's someone else's turn to talk, the interpersonal skills needed in order to read a room and understand how you feel and stay in control, even if how you feel is upset. And so I left. I made that really difficult decision to leave teaching. Oh, wow. Because the solution to this was working directly with the parents between birth to five.
Okay. So then let's walk. So I like where this is going. So then tell us about after you left, decided that this is maybe not the place for you. You can create something of your own. And then What did you do? How did you create it?
Well, this is the best part of all, because I am a data-driven person. I really like to see results in action. And the goal wasn't, could I create something that would positively impact young kids during those years? It was, could I create something that I could teach to parents would be able to apply it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to positively impact young kids? And so with a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old at home, I went back to one of my first jobs, my true loves, full-time nannying.
Oh, wow.
And I got my hands dirty with these infants and these toddlers and teaching the parents how to do what I was designing. And that was an amazing journey. And I did that for 8 years for 2 families from birth of child until they went to preschool.
Oh, wow.
And so over that time, I had infants and toddlers, and I also had tweens and teens.
What an interesting dichotomy there.
It is. They are the same person.
Yeah.
Toddlers and teenagers are the same person. They're going through different phases of life, massive growth evolutions, large hormonal changes. There's different natural consequences to their decisions that they make, whether you're 2 or you're 12. But the way that we support them through those really transformative moments is exactly the same. And that's what I learned.
And so so I'm hearing you say you focus on the 0 to 5, because that's those formative years. And before we kind of go dive deep into the, what if the listener hears, oh, my kid is 8 or 9 and I didn't have these skill sets. I didn't have these tools. I didn't know I was doing the best that I could. What do you tell a parent in that phase and in that part of the child's development?
It is never too late. That's the general message. Now, obviously, the way that you're going to talk to your child, the conversations that you're going to have, they're going to be at a deeper level because they are now developmentally and cognitively able to process more than they were when they were young. But the core skills that your child needs to be practicing in order to be a successful human, a good friend, a good student, and go out and find success haven't changed. And so it's never too late to start that dialogue.
That's great. Okay. So everybody's listening. It's never too late. So with that in mind, because I think that kind of helps almost bring the cortisol level down. Because when I hear something, I'm like, oh, I should have been doing this for years. And now I've, you know, because I think that's where moms are today. It's I messed up my kid and they're never going to recover. And so it's never too late. So with that in mind, so let's dive deep into how do you teach these things? What are the things that you teach to parents? And I want to just say, I love that you're focusing on the parents because, you know, as a parent myself, right? Like those, I need the skill set because I am dealing with my child. You know, they go to school, they're at care for a period of time and they're completely different. I mean, the environment is different. You know, I mean, it's almost like you have two children because they're like perfect at school and they come home and it's like, what is going on? And so I think it's really important to help parents. And so I'm really glad that you're like supporting parents through this phase. So yeah. So why don't we talk about some of the skill sets? So what are some of the things that are important if you do have a 0 to 5-year-old, like what are some of the stuff that you're teaching parents to help children flourish?
Okay. So I just want to say one thing about what you said. Every single human being, now we're talking birth to five, but this applies to everybody. You wake up in the morning and you have a prescribed amount of what I call your buffer, right? You have your patience for the day. You have your flexibility thinking for the day. You have your perspective for the day. You have, and every time you get triggered, every time you encounter a struggle and you eat up some of it, it dissipates and you have less and less and less. And this is why you have two different kids. If this is you and you're listening and you're like, when my kids go in the world, they tell me they're perfect and they come home and I'm like, they are the Tasmanian devil hooligans puddles on the floor meltdowning, then you're doing a great job. Okay. We're clapping for you over here because it means that you have armed your children with what they need to go out into the world and use their buffer. Okay. So the skills that we need to be successful out there. There's 5 executive functioning skills that healthy adults use to engage with the world. Well, there's way more than 5, but I've distilled it down to the 5 that our post-pandemic kids missed out on so many opportunities, right? Repetition is how we learn. And they had minimal opportunities to practice a whole lot of these, both inside and outside of the home. So the first one is delayed gratification, the ability to wait. It's becoming a lost art as it is in the world we live in.
Even for adults, I'll have to, I'm the first to admit.
Here's the deal. Every single one of these I'm going to say, you're going to be like, this applies to a 5-year-old, a 15-year-old, a 55-year-old, and everybody else,
right?
Because it's the psychology of human nature.
Yeah.
That's it. So this ability to wait. And when we're talking specifically about littles, that is really hard for them because they are egotistical little creatures who are in their own beautiful toddler and preschooler brains. They always want to be first in line. They always want to be first done. They always want the first cup, right? This is just their pre-programming. Mm-hmm. And it's us that has to teach them, okay, waiting is hard, but I'm going to teach you why it matters. The ability to understand how to be inside of a patient body and trust that the outcome will show up is a really important skill. I've said it a couple times already, so maybe I've given it away, but the ability to be a flexible thinker, to know that something might happen or it might not.
So
to
important.
Show up at your favorite restaurant on Saturday morning where you always get your Mickey Mouse pancakes with chocolate chips and find out that day they're closed. Now we have to come up with this is unexpected, but it's not going to shut me down. I know that I can think about this a different way and apply a different perspective and come up with a new plan. Another one that is really important is time management. Especially during the pandemic, what happens when people are so out of control is that they take control of everything. And so our little people didn't have to do any of this thinking for themselves. We micromanaged and created every moment of the day. And so time management from the perspective of a 3-year-old is something that they need to start thinking about because there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to creating a plan. There, if somebody comes up with a struggle and they say, what is the first thing that I can do to try to solve this? I can't find the shoes that I love, that are my favorite, that I wear to school every single day. Instead of immediately, and this is the fourth one, emotional regulation, immediately dysregulating, losing control completely, crying, screaming, whining, and dropping to the floor, tagging into, wait, I've had this problem before. The first thing I did last time was check my backpack. Maybe they're still in there from yesterday. We need to get them thinking about this cognitive solving process, because that's basically what they do all day, every day. Yeah. And then the fifth skill that I bring to the table that is really unique is what I call sense of self. I believe that as parents, it is our job to be narrating for our kids who they are. And that means that we are taking time to deeply observe them. You are somebody who really likes things when they're organized. I see that about you. You are someone who loves people so deeply that every time we go to the grocery store, you want to make sure we pick up something for your sister too. What a big heart you have. I think it's so important that kids are told their beautiful nature and the qualities that they have from a young age, because when they bump up against hard things, those are what they're going to need to feel self-confident, self-aware, to advocate for themselves. And it's our gift to be able to see that in them and reflect it back.
That's beautiful. I mean, I think just for that fifth one, that sense of self, I think a question that comes to mind is, what do you tell the parents? Because it seems very intuitive or easy to observe something and then say it. But that's not always intuitive for a lot of parents, because either they haven't been brought up like that, or it's just, you know, it's pointing out something that seems almost too obvious. And so how do you even, if somebody doesn't have the language even around it, because I think as parents, you know, we're talking about from different generations, different mm-hmm. ways of just upbringing, culture, all that kind of stuff matters. And so how do you coach a parent to even do something, which seems very simple, but I can see it's very impactful for the child.
So impactful. So in my Transforming the Toddler Years course, we have 6 modules. And one of them is called the language of littles. And I go so deep into the intentional language script starters that serve to do a couple things. One, they immediately connect you and your child. You have each other's undivided attention simply because of the words you've started using. And they turn on your child's cognition. So when we ask simple yes or no questions, we are not really asking our kids to think. We're just asking them to auditorily react. But when we use leading cues that require them to stop, think, and then formulate an answer, even if they can't talk yet, even if it's by showing us the response, even if it's by signing it back to us with baby sign, we are automatically setting up, we're cycle breaking, right? Mm-hmm. We're giving our kids a voice before they have one. And then we're giving them a bigger voice and allowing them their opinions and their decision-making processes, even when they are really, really young.
That's so interesting. And then I'm sure you've encountered with the parents that you've already worked with, but what about those children that don't like people labeling things for them, where they get really, or maybe you're wrong. Maybe you observe something and they get dysregulated. And so they can't even take in what you're saying. Like, what do you do at that point?
Those are fabulous questions. And they're really 2 different ones. So I'll tackle them separately. So I love being told I'm wrong. I love that. Right. I work really hard not to make assumptions. I work really hard not to put stuff out there that I don't think is true. But very often I will be told that. My daughter would do this to me all the time. I'd say, I bet that was really hard for you because one of the things that you really like is being organized. Because that's her. And she was like, that's actually not the reason why this time, Mom. Let me tell you why. I love being told I'm wrong because then it opens up that bigger dialogue and something new that she might be dealing with all of a sudden is on my radar. And 90% of the time, it ended up not being about her. It ended up being about somebody else.
Interesting.
Right? So because there's things that we show the world that feel really good to us, like the organization piece for her. That's not a skill. That's a trait, right? That's something that she uses to feel good and comfortable in her space. But one of her natural skills is compassion and empathy for a fellow human being. And so when I tagged into the trait and then she said, no, mom, you're wrong. This time, the problem was that the student in my class, I felt wasn't being fairly dealt with. And it really upset me. Now we're into a human nature conversation.
Yeah, it's not always so it's linear. Just, wow, that's
no, it's not. Because we're humans. We're humans. Okay, so your second question was when they're too far gone. Now this is extremely obvious when we're in the 0 to 5 space. Too far gone visually and auditorily is right in front of us. They're melting down. They're tantruming. They are literally hiding, maybe going into a little ball. Older kids, it's actually the opposite. The too far gone can be when they go completely internal. They get super quiet. They do not make eye contact. It's like they put on their invisible armor.
Yeah.
So just know, right? Toddlers, teenagers, same people. Mm-hmm. They handle some things different ways sometimes. When they're too far gone, they're too far gone. That's it. That's all there is to it. They're all sensory at that point. They're all feeling. They're all emotion. So no amount of cognitive wizardry or perfectly chosen words is going to get to them in that moment, except for permission-based language. So if you've got a screaming kiddo and they're just gone, at some point they've got to take a breath. They have to, there's going to be a second where they have to regroup. In that second, you want to say, you're really upset right now. In that next moment where there's a space for you to say something, you're allowed to feel this way. I'm going to sit with you inside of it. When you're ready, I'll be here to listen to you. Just permission. That's it. Because energy has to move.
Yes, that's so true.
And meltdowns are energy. Tantrums are energy. Dysregulated energy inside our body. Feelings. Energy in motion. Emotions. Right? Has to come out. So you got to let it come out. As long as they're safe, let it come out. It's afterwards that you get to, when everybody's back to center, say, wow, that was a lot of emotion that came out of you. You had so many feelings about this thing that just happened. Ooh, I hope next time when this happens, like when your brother takes your toy, whatever it might be, you know, when we got up late and so we had to skip this thing we always do before we leave. I hope next time that happens, that maybe there's a way we can do it differently. And then I always open it up to them.
For them because, to, yeah, I like that. Yeah.
Do you have any ideas? Do you think, what do you think we should try next time? And I'll help you by reminding you when I notice that you're starting to not feel good inside your body. Because here's the thing, it doesn't feel good. Kids aren't bad when they're melting down. It doesn't feel good to them. Meltdowns are behavior. Behavior is communication.
Yes. Yeah.
They're just telling us something is not right and I need you to help me fix it.
Yeah. Yeah. And as parents, it's like, you've got to be an investigator as to what is this? What does this behavior mean? And that is hard. That is not an easy thing to do. It takes a lot of practice. And sometimes you're not, and I feel like you have to accept as a parent, sometimes you're not going to know. And that's okay too, because that's just part of the parenting process, I think, is as long as you're showing up and asking the questions. And I love what you said about asking them for their opinions, because I find that even when we do this, they come up with such great ideas and some things that I would never have thought about and works. And we're like, okay, I've already got your buy-in. So
exactly. And you know, quite honestly, as adults, we overcomplicate.
Yes.
We've already gone out in our mind and bought the new bunk bed as the solution to not sleeping, when really it's that they're going to bed with the wrong stuffy. Like, why do we do this to ourselves when we could have this beautiful open conversation? And they would just be like, it's because I needed the red one. And you, oh, okay.
Yeah. So why don't we kind of go into parenting during the pandemic? And I bring this up because A, you know, this is part of what you do, but B, as we're talking, I am thinking about the parents' mindset, their own fears, their own anxiety. You know, the pandemic, we're here 4 years later, right? Since the pandemic started, 3 years later, 4 years later, it's hard to even keep track, honestly. And, you know, it's when something has happened in the past, it's easy to forget what our, where our minds were and what we were feeling and how we may have reacted or responded in different ways. And so what do you tell parents, like, how was that period? Let's just talk about the like parenting through the pandemic and what that looked like, especially as the parents that you helped during this period. What were they saying? What were they feeling? And how were you helping them manage their own, really their own emotions? Because when you're trying to, if you're working and you're trying to manage children, or even if you're not working, then you're not working and you're worried about not work, you know, so there's so many things going on during this period.
Well, the first thing I always, during that pandemic period, the world stopped on a dime, right? So the first thing that everybody was telling me is I just got to survive this. Those were the words coming out of their mouth. I've just got to survive this. And so we were literally one day living lives, the next day in survival mode. So that's where, like, lizard brain, right? The ancient brain of ours, where something is coming to eat us, it kicks in. That's survival mode. That's cortisol all day long. Survival mode is a really great space for your body to be in order to keep ourselves safe. But it is not meant to be the space that we are in for any length of time. Consistently, we're supposed to cycle through it. And more than that, nobody knew when it was coming to an end, right? If someone dropped you off on a desert island and said, I'll be back in 7 days, you're in survival mode, but you know when it's going to be over. This went on and on and on. So for parents, regardless of their situation, working, not working, now remote working, lost their job, lost their child care, parents had to move in to help. Regardless of all of those extra pieces, their brain, their body, and their soul was just in survival mode. And so what I were noticing now, and there was an identity piece. So parents identified, I shouldn't move on until I say that, as a pandemic mom or a pandemic dad. They identified their children as COVID babies or COVID toddlers. Everybody was in it together. This was just the way of the world. There was also a lot of fear around health and safety. And fear and guilt are best friends.
Oh, yes.
So if you're afraid to go out and get groceries, but you do it anyway, if you choose to wear the mask, if you don't choose to wear the mask, if someone else near you comes to visit and you allow them not to wear the mask, these are all choices that we were forced to make without knowing what the outcomes would be. And whether, and then your child gets sick and it, maybe it's not COVID.
Right.
Maybe they just get sick and you're like, oh, I did this. This is because I didn't wear a mask when I went to the post office. Did I bring this home? Right. The variables that were so unknown that you could never know the answer. And yet parents just tortured themselves because our number one job in our DNA from the minute we bring a child into the world is to protect them. And we were in a lose-lose world where we had no idea if we were effectively doing it.
And do you find, you know, well, A, I kind of want to go into what your definition of a pandemic mom and dad is, because it's interesting. I saw something you'd posted and it was even pre, like if you had a child, you know, sort of pre the date of the pandemic, you're still considered a pandemic parent because you were raising a child through this period, the very young years. So, so I kind of want to pause there and get your feedback as to what would you define as a pandemic parent and why?
Love it. Thank you for that opportunity. Yeah. So for me, definitions always are in the scope of somebody's experience. So if you experienced 24/7, 7 days a week, caring for another human being who was at that point either not here yet or right or between in those small ages, then you are a pandemic parent because you experienced it. You lived it. So true pandemic babies, the ones that all the data is being collected on, and we're now starting to see the articles come out with delayed milestones and all that, those kiddos are born in 20 and 21. But if you had a kiddo in 2017 and the world shut down in March of 2020, how old were they? They were 3 years old. What's happening at 3 years old? Major developmental leaps, huge growth milestones. What else is happening? They are a pre-existing kid in the world. So for 3 years, they learned that you spend some of your time at home and some of your time at daycare or preschool, that you get to hang out with family, you get to hang out with friends. They learned how to be social with others, and they were in the middle of a lot of growth, and all I call it the pandemic pause. And there goes that learning leap. There goes those learning opportunities. Some preschools tried to do Zoom school. I was like, whoa, three-year-olds cannot do Zoom school, my friends. So who are they now? They're kindergartners. They're first graders in this post-pandemic learning model. And one of the things that I am shouting loudly from the rooftops is the schools have not changed their expectations for achievement, even though your children didn't continue to have the opportunities to learn the skills to hit those achievement boxes. So I just want you to know, you cannot put all of your eggs in that basket. You just have to say to yourself, my child had a different experience. This is a pre-COVID assessment. My child lived a COVID life, and I need to advocate for them.
And what does that look like? What does advocation look like when you have a child that lived through the pandemic?
I will talk to the other side of it, to be fair, because as a former classroom teacher, I did not teach through COVID. I didn't have to do the online teaching. It was incredibly overwhelming. Talk about people who were in survival mode. Oh, those poor teachers, my heart, every time. I have my dear friend, who's a first grade teacher, watching that experience. Nothing has really changed for these poor teachers, except the rules and regulations have tightened, right? And every single day, they are now basically doing classroom management all day long and not really getting a lot of opportunities to do true teaching. So they are overwhelmed, exhausted, and wrecked, maybe more than they were during the pandemic. So with that said, be loving, kind, and gentle with your advocation words.
I love it.
Go to these teachers and say, you have been through it. The fact that you're still here is amazing. And I'm so grateful that you are with my child every day. But I also know that he is just not hitting the milestones. And therefore, he's not going to perform on these assessments. And I'm okay with that. Like, let them know that you're just okay with that, that you're now in this for your child's journey. You're meeting them where they are. You're not feeling compelled like we used to make sure that they checked all the success boxes at school.
I love that. I love I just want to reiterate the kind and loving words to your teachers, because those are the people that are with your kids every single day. And just somebody validating somebody else's experience and the challenges that they have every single day, because they're navigating completely new things, right? Like they've seen children pre-pandemic, now they're post-pandemic, and then they're managing their own teaching styles and all that kind of stuff. So it is a lot. So I think that is, you can't say that enough, to just be kind to your teachers. And they appreciate it, I think, a lot. So you have parents through this pandemic period, you have kids that have not maybe gotten the skills that they would have typically been taught. I sort of go back to the parents during this period as well, because you talk about that lizard brain and this chronic lizard brain that you have, right? And I feel like some parents are still in that phase because they haven't really been able to regulate, because they, for 3 years, there was this really huge unknown. And now we're in a different world. So what you may have thought a few years ago might have made sense for your child or for yourself, it doesn't make sense anymore. And so we're still in this mysterious, unknown, we're charting new paths. And so how do you, you know, as we talk about teaching the parent skills to then teach our kids, if a parent themselves is just so dysregulated in maybe a chronic state, and they haven't actually ever been able to like get in enough what they need, like how do you even begin to untangle that to then be able to help even get the skill set for the parents to then pass down to their kids?
This is so important. One of the things that was true about that elongated survival mode is that it came with kind of a blanket, a really heavy blanket of hard feelings, stress, overwhelm, fear. Those are felt, right? Those are absorbed by the people around us. And so the climate of our home was really all that, right? It was heavy. It was murky. Could cut it with a knife type of thing. Mm-hmm. Kids felt that. Parents are now starting to say to me, back to that identity piece, I don't identify as a pandemic parent anymore, right? I've moved past that identification, but I can't break out of the way I was living. Right. And of course they can't, because when we do something for such a long period of time, it literally becomes part of our cellular package. It becomes habitual.
Yes.
Yeah. That the very first thing you do when you wake up is you worry about what's wrong.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That the very first thing you do when you engage your kids is wonder if today is going to be the day there's 10 meltdowns. That you almost approach this parenting thing from a place of fear. Mm-hmm. And I get it. So the very first thing I do is I say to these parents, you have to choose to draw a very clear line between then and now. You have to like train your brain. That was then. This is now. Then I had no choices. Now I get choice. Just that mere foundation mm-hmm. of, oh, I'm an autonomous creature again.
Right. Which okay. is so easy to forget. I mean, it sounds so ridiculous when you're like, oh, I have a choice, but it really is that easily forgotten. It really is.
Yeah. So number one, there's a then and there's a now. Number two is forgiveness. You must forgive yourself for everything that you did, even though you wouldn't have normally chosen to do it, particularly tech. Mm. I have a lot of parents that have a lot of guilt around access to technology and media time for their kids and screen time during the pandemic. And I understand it because we are seeing 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds with tech addictions. Right. This is the outcome. Everything has an outcome, but we cannot do anything about redefining a child's relationship with technology or redefining a child's relationship with having to use words until we forgive ourselves for whatever we had to do to survive that time period. So those are the very first things we do.
And so speaking of technology, that's a really, I mean, we could go on for a long time for that, but, you know, maybe in just a few minutes. What's your take on technology for those parents and for any parent really that has maybe a child that maybe isn't addicted to it, but they don't like how much reliance that they have had to have on technology, and it's a show or it's whatever the kids mm-hmm. are watching, or the parents are so dysregulated, they just need a break and they give them a tablet or a show. What's your take on technology and if they went through this period where they were watching for a long time, do you see it being unwound? Because as a child, I can't imagine it's like having access to something that is very enticing and pleasurable mm-hmm. and all this kind of stuff. Do you see it being unwound, or is it just like, I guess, like where are you with technology? It's such a loaded question, I know, but
such a loaded question. I got you. So first thing I want to say is kids of that age bracket, well, all of them particularly, but that really impressionable, I'm still making sense of the world age bracket, are during the pandemic with excess screen time and tech time, they identified that as a self-soothing strategy. So you've got the big emotions, the big energy, the big meltdowns, everybody's feeling it. And every time a parent handed their child a device to make it stop, that child identified this as a self-soothing input. So now you've got older kids who believe, truly, if I don't feel okay in my own body, in my own mind, in my own space, all I have to do is pick something up to calm myself down. This summer, I live in Vermont. I told you this summer we had a very unexpected event. We had a massive flood and it took out tons of infrastructure. You may have seen it on the news. We very rarely make the national news. And I was volunteering at the local shelter over this 2-week period. And this family with 8 kids came in.
Oh, wow.
And they had kids between 2 and 20. I mean, just like huge break. And I said, I've got the youngers, like, I'll keep them while you guys get changed and whatever, and go shop the, what they needed to take home and be okay. And this little kid looked at me and she looked at all the toys that I had laid out. And she said, where's the tablet? So seeking it beyond what was even in her space to play with. Here's my take on tech, and I'll stand by it. I say it everywhere. I believe technology is a tool and not a toy. And I tell kids that technology is a tool and not a toy. And I believe that the unwinding will not happen organically, that we are going to have to, just like if a child has created unhealthy sleep associations and habits, we have to detach that cause and effect belief that they have in their brain and reconnect it with a healthy one. We're going to have to do that with technology. I recently had someone on my podcast and she designed, her name's Meredith DiPaolo, and she designed an app called Carrots and Cake. And it is a technology screen limiting app where you program it that your kids have 20 minutes that they have to do their music lesson online or their homework or their this or their that. So it's the education piece. Mm-hmm. And then it opens up what they want to do, their self-soothing choice for a limited amount of time. And then the machine shuts itself down and it will not turn on until tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
So it takes the onus off of you
having to micromanage it or control it or, oh, interesting. Yeah.
And it retrains their brain. When I do these and I am now out of time, I am done until tomorrow, and you can wean it down.
That's interesting. I like that. I think tech is such a big topic, and I know a lot of parents are confused as to like, what do we do? And so I don't think there is a right answer. I think it's just a matter of figuring out what works for you or your family, mm-hmm. what the outcome you want it to be.
Well, and because the truth is you're raising a digital citizen here.
Yeah.
As much as I don't love the term, it's true. So what you want is to raise a child with enough self-awareness, right? That sense of self, to be able to internally decide when to turn it on and when to turn it off. And that is through their entire lives, because the world will ask them to use technology for school, for managing their money, for interviewing for a potential job. The technology piece is going nowhere. What needs to change is the way we interact with it.
Well, Kara, I think this was such a great conversation. I want to leave a few minutes to so you can have an opportunity to tell the audience where to find you, you know, where they can follow you. And if they're interested in the course that you teach and they have young children, where they can get all that information. And then we'll take a few minutes to do our OPD segment.
Sounds fantastic. Thank you everyone so much for even taking time to listen to this. That means you're just a proactive parent. And that's exactly who I love to work with. So if you're interested, I am at Core4Parenting with the number 4 in the middle on Instagram, where I'm most active. Please come on over and follow my podcast, Transforming the Toddler Years. You're going to learn so much more about my collaborative parenting methodology. And if this aligns for you, if you're someone who's ready to step into that space of learning and growing alongside your child through their early years. And then my course opens every quarter. So we'll make sure that you have the link to put into the show notes, but I only open it every 12 weeks because we get together live and I teach you and I get to coach you every step of the way through the Transforming the Toddler Years modules.
That's wonderful. And so I'm assuming that there are parents from that have children all through the different ranges. And so do you get to interact with them and hear feedback as to what's working, what's not working?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And it's why I committed to forever teaching this online and live, because the modules don't change, right? The magic of mindset, the power of perspective, the science of your strategies, they're all in there. Mm-hmm. But if you're taking the course with an 18-month-old and the person sitting next to you in our digital classroom has a 3-year-old, you get a little bit of a flash forward of how you can apply these exact same strategies and the exact same language to that next development. Mental leap that's coming.
I love that. I love it. We'll put everything in the show notes. And so I encourage everybody to follow Kara. So Kara, we have this OPD segment that I started in season 2, which is just a way to get a little different perspective on what other people do. And so I'm going to ask you 2 random questions. I'm going to answer them myself. And then hopefully a parent out there might hear it and think, huh, that's an interesting thing that they can put in their repertoire. So kind of staying in the parenting space, I'm curious, do you have different parenting styles or philosophy than a co-parent? And how did you manage or how's that changed?
Ooh, okay. Yeah, that's super juicy. I 100% have a different parenting style than my husband. And I made it very clear from the beginning. I have a clear vision of who I want to be as a mom in relationship to my kids and who I want to raise, and the way that I intend to do that. And so I will continue an open dialogue with you about this, but I'm going to ask you, if you feel compelled to jump in with old cycle thinking or old cycle language or actions, just check with me first, mm-hmm. because I would get 90%, parents are totally going to get this, right?
Yes.
Like you do the work and you pick the strategy and you apply your perspective and you can see your child finally starting to turn the corner. And then your partner comes in and does the last 10% and wipes the slate completely clean again.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Too many times.
So it sounds like you've got a check-in. So you've sort of established a check-in kind of thing where it's, mm-hmm. let's not interrupt the train while it's on. Yeah, no, that's a really good tactic. I mean, I think this is a really challenging space, I think, for any parent, because we come into a relationship with very different ideas, very different past. And I think it's interesting, and I'll just give you an experience of my own parenting, kind of co-parenting strategies. I am a mom who likes to learn. I like to, you know, I'm trying to raise, and there's some intuitive things that just have come to me, but I do also like the science and the data. And so I'm always researching. And me and my husband, we come from similar backgrounds, but very different life experiences when we were kids, how we were raised. And we do have different parenting styles in certain aspects. I think for me, the more I've communicated and just really done my own thing, I think when you see something happen and there's some positive changes, it's almost like you don't have to nag somebody, because I've learned that the hard way. It's like nagging doesn't really help. And if you're just sort of doing your own thing, it almost, you're just modeling it. And we do come together now. Now we're in a space where we respect each other's parenting styles, because they can be different. And as long as you're sort of aligned with the, you both want to raise good children. And I think as long as you keep that in mind, even when somebody steps in, because that's going to happen inevitably, to just realize you can't control the other person, you can only control yourself and your reactions. And so that is what I'm working on currently. So to all the parents out there with challenges, you know, you're not alone. And the last thing, I'm going to make this a really very simple thing. Do you cook every day when you had young children?
When I had young children?
Young children.
Yes. Yes. So I live on a family farm. Oh. And so we have this beautiful backyard and a greenhouse. And we actually ran a CSA when our kids were little. And so cooking with fresh food was something that was really, really important in our family.
Oh, that's so wonderful. We are sort of a mix. We are both working parents. And so it's not always feasible for us to cook fresh. So we do We try to do batch cooking on the weekends. We do leftovers. Sometimes the kids are not happy about that, but it's one of those things where you, it's one of the things that you teach your kids, like, you know, we're not going to always have the same thing every single day. But I think for all the parents, I think the guilt component of that is something that I always like to tell people. It's like, you do what you can. It's what is at your capacity, and that is enough. And so there are different seasons of life. As you get through the age ranges, things will loosen up. Things will, you know, you'll learn and stuff. So for me personally, we try to do as much cooking as we can, but there are definitely takeout nights and leftovers.
Can I just also say for people that have kids in those middle ranges, if you, first of all, if you have a 9-year-old, you're halfway there, right? It's so easy to get lost in those middle years, right? If you have a 9-year-old, you're halfway there, and they are so capable. So if you've got 9, 10, 11, 12 year olds, what we did during that time frame is we assigned each of them a night to cook.
Oh.
And I provided the recipes. I made them a little book, like mom's recipe book. And they had watched me make it so many times. And sometimes we'd end up cooking together, but how cool was that?
I love that.
So start involving them. Like if one of your family's mission statements is that we eat healthy food and we make it ourselves most of the time, then the family gets to be part of that experience, not just you.
Oh, Cara, I think that's such a great way to end this. So like just to sometimes just taking a step back and looking at it from a perspective of the, because when you're in it, you're in it, and it's really hard to zoom out. So I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your information and the resources that I think it's great what you're doing for parents. And it was great talking with you.
You too. Thank you so much for this space and for sharing this with everybody.
Absolutely. Take care.
Well, guys, I hope that you enjoyed that conversation. I know there were so many takeaways and things that I learned from Cara, and so I wanted to summarize them here. Number one, it is never too late to start. Even if you're past those 0 to 5 years, maybe your kids are way older, it doesn't matter the age. There's always something that you can do to connect with them. Number two, the concept of the buffer that you wake up with. I really like this and how she phrased it, and mostly because I'm sure that most of you could relate. If your children are losing it when they come home, it doesn't mean that you're doing anything wrong. And I would go so far as to saying what Cara said, just give yourself a pat on the back. It just means that you've armed them with the skills that they need to go out into the world. Number three, we talk about the 5 core executive skills. I'm going to list them here, and she's got a course that actually goes through them in a lot of detail. These are 5 skills that she teaches children: delayed gratification, flexible thinking, time management, emotional regulation, and sense of self. I think those are really 5 key things that, as she said, every single person can have help with. Number 4, when children are in a dysregulated state, they are not going to hear words, except for permission-based language. So don't do a lot of talking, allow them to be, and at the end of it, talk to them about it and have them included in ways that they can potentially change what happens next time, and that you'll be there to remind them. And last but not least, we all went through this pandemic period in very different circumstances and a lot of unique experiences, but to remind ourselves that we were in a survival mode for a period of time. Be kind to yourself, be gentle, and again, just know that you can forgive yourself and move on. So if you've enjoyed this show, please follow now, share it with a friend, and rate the podcast. I love having these conversations and I love sharing them with you, and I can't wait to be sharing more episodes that are coming up soon. Till next time, happy connecting.